This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town. Your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Hellfire Club, the Dungeons and Dragons Club in Stranger Things. You might have seen the t-shirts everywhere. Well, Hellfire Club may actually be helpful in schools. So programs are now rolling out across the country. They use a type of modified educational version of D&D designed to teach neurodivergent kids important skills like social communication, teamwork, and flexible thinking. So did you play Dungeons and Dragons? Maybe you still do. And can you see how role-play games could help kids, especially kids who are neurodiverse? But up first, as you've been hearing all morning, there's a lot of chat about activity centres. This is Bob and Charnel from our breakfast program.
Do you agree with high-rise apartment hubs? Let's stop saying activity centres.
Well, if you hear us say it, just know that there's quotation marks in the air and they're done in a really exasperated, sarcastic fashion.
Activity centres.
It's just a misleading and it's an outrageous rebranding of what it actually is.
So what is an activity centre? What does the term mean? Where did it come from? Is this a term that is just used here in Melbourne and in Australia? And do we use the term activity centre as a bit of spin, a way to conjure up images of a thriving community so that we don't have to use terms like high rise?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
High-rise apartments of up to 20 stories could be built at so-called activity centres in Melbourne's southeast, according to new draft plans released by the state government.
So-called activity centres. So how did they get called that and where did the term come from? What is the actual definition of an activity centre? What needs to be in the area for it to be an activity centre? Is it a term that just we use here in Melbourne? And has it simply been created as a way to generate the spin around the state government's housing plan? What do you think of when we say activity centre? A woman that knows all things spin, Dee Madigan, advertising expert. Dee, I think originally the term may have started back in the early 2000s when the state government came up with their 2030 planning policy. Since then, we sort of haven't used it much. Is it just a bit of spin?
Look, yes and no. Obviously, as you alluded to, you don't want to be using the word high-rise, right, because it conjures up all sorts of negative connotations. And in a lot of places around Sydney, for example, when they're doing this, they're calling them entertainment precincts, which sort of sounds good, except if you were like a family. And I reckon that's what they're trying to do here, is say, like, entertainment precinct says, you know, lots of bars and cool shops and things open late and whatever, but that's not something you possibly want when you've got a couple of small children. And I think that that's what they're appealing to. And activity centres are something parents understand really well. So you would expect then it's about playgrounds and parks as well as transport. Look, it's pretty weird, but I don't hate it on the basis of that.
Mm. I feel like the more often it gets used by officials anyhow, the more it legitimises the concept. I just wonder whether it needs to be scrutinised as to whether or not it ticks all the boxes of what is an activity centre and whether or not there needs to be actual infrastructure there first, or whether the infrastructure gets built so then it can become an activity centre. I mean, there's a text here from Josh that says, surely we all understand what an activity centre is. Shops and transport. In fact, I would suggest it's the perfect term to describe what we all know. I'm pretty sure if you ask someone in the nearest activity centre near them, they could do so. Caulfield being a case in point. No one would question that that's an activity centre. So does it always, I mean, does it have a positive spin on it, do you think?
I think it deliberately does, because it's a moving word, isn't it? Activity. Mm. It's nothing, there's nothing passive about it. The only word I don't like on there, bizarrely, is the word centre. Because that sounds kind of bureaucratic, like an activity precinct might have been, or an activity hub or something, whereas activity centres are a little bit strange. That, to me, goes to childcare centres. But you know, as I said, yes, you absolutely have to have the infrastructure there, but nothing nowadays. People are pretty good at building that. I do think in Australia we just need to change the way we look at housing and living, because, you know, we simply can't all be, you know, affording to buy a house anymore, so we have to change how that looks and feels, and I think that's probably, this is part of it. The other thing, though, is if you're trying to do a word that says every single thing or a phrase, that you end up with a, you know, a 27-page name. So at some point, you, as you've just sort of said before, you have to almost choose a name, stick to it, keep talking about it, and then it becomes real.
Legitimised, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you say there are, and whether or not that's changing and shifting, depending on whether or not you live there, but the term high-rise, I wonder whether activity centres has come in because there has been a pushback against not using a term. And ironically, we are pulling down high-rise apartments in order to build more high-rise apartments. But I want to have a chat with Susanna, who's in Mont Albert, while we have you, Dee. Hi, Susanna.
Oh, hi, Rochelle. I wanted to mention a language use that I've noticed from the government where they refer to tree removal, which I think is a really gentle way to spin cutting down trees or felling trees. And I even saw a local park where a lot of trees ended up being cut down. They called it the rejuvenation of the park, where in reality they cut down trees and planted little trees. And I just feel like it's this constant use of spin and language to kind of cover the reality of what's happening. And I just think let's be more honest and more clear about what's actually going on.
I like that, the idea of just using language to cover the reality of what's actually happening. But if you're asked, fundamentally, the truth is there, right? But it's just given to us in a way that feels a little softer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Dee, what do you reckon? Tree removal? Good
well,
example.
I would hope that they were probably going to put back some other sort of greenery. But, yeah, no, I take the point. You know, governments will talk about, you know, natural attrition when they really mean we're not employing enough staff. Yeah, words are done all the time, and that's even the Greeks used to have people whose jobs were, like back in ancient Greece, their job was to present government's arguments in a persuasive term. So this isn't a new phenomenon.
Always good to get your thoughts on this, Dee. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Dee Madigan, advertising expert. Rish, Activity Centres is from the 2030. In 2002, the activity centres were identified based on transport, access, services, jobs and suitability for growth. The activity housing zone is all around the activity centre that moves out. That's from Malcolm in Blackburn. So the 2030 policy, that's where the idea did come from. And it looked at everything from the location and purpose of these areas, and some of the key development areas back in early 2000 that were identified were Sunshine, Knox City, Cranbourne, Doncaster, Narre Warren and Fountain Gate. And it was a pilot program even back then to ensure that these areas had all of the infrastructure needed. But that's a part of the argument from locals, isn't it? That infrastructure isn't there, that the schools aren't big enough, there's not enough daycare centres, that there's not enough parking, that the livability isn't up to scratch to be able to accommodate 20 stories. So is your activity centre ready? When we say activity centre, do you really know what we mean? Simon Knott is an architect from BKK Architects. Simon, you've been right behind all types of planning, from public towers through to city infrastructure. Do we really know what an activity centre means? Like, is there an actual definition? Do you have to tick boxes to be called an activity centre?
Hi, Shell. Look, I think like in all things planning, there's never, once we start to try and get down to exact specific definitions that cover all cases, it starts to fall apart. So I think there is an understanding of what it is. There's a definition within Plan Victoria, which is the old Plan Melbourne. It's been expanded out, which as it should be, to cover more the other regions in Victoria. And the way it's categorised is to look at, I mean, this derives from the idea of the 20-minute walk, 20-minute neighbourhood. And people sort of wonder what that is. Is it just a marketing term? But this is not something specific to Australia that someone's just cooked up. This is widespread planning, urban planning theory from around the world, in that if we need to stop the urban sprawl and the cost of urban sprawl, it's both a financial cost and an environmental cost and a social cost, actually, of moving out into the outer suburbs, we need to densify. And so what we're looking to do is, rather than just put all the housing in one spot and the commerce over here, is actually create mini centres all around the city. And if you look at a place like Tokyo, like Japan or somewhere around, Tokyo has a whole lot of different districts, or Paris does as well. And within those are a whole range of uses. And it should be, everything within your life. That's the idea of the 20 minute neighborhood.
I guess the pushback, though, from a lot of people is, yes, the activity center, we may tick all the boxes here in terms of us having the schools and the train stations. But Spiros, for example, in Geelong has just said, yeah, but the infrastructure requirements, they need to be improved as well. So they might be there, but they're probably not up to scratch. You know, maybe the platforms aren't long enough. There's not enough platforms. There's not enough toilets there, or just that the train station is really old and dodgy and dingy, not enough lighting, you name it. So does the infrastructure need to be improved with the population growth of these areas?
Absolutely. And I don't think anyone's pretending it doesn't. I think whenever you, there's not just a housing shortage. If you build, hundreds of thousands of new housing modules, whatever they are, whether they're houses or apartments, dwellings, then you need to have appropriate infrastructure as well. So what this proposal is saying, these activity centre 20-minute neighbourhood proposal is saying, is that you build upon the existing. It's far easier to build upon existing school infrastructure, make them bigger, make the existing transport network bigger or have greater capacity within it, or hospitals to expand them rather than building a new ones. And we've seen the examples, say, out in the growth corridors in the West, where they're crying out for all of that. They're crying out for police stations, for hospitals, for train stations, for everything.
I wonder how much people believe that, though. There are suburbs where there's been a promise of a school or a train station, and then decades down the track, they're still not there. So it's a bit sort of chicken and egg, like, okay, you're going to build these 20 stories, and yes, we will improve the train station. Trust us. Is that trust there?
But what you do get, and this becomes the, I guess, a sort of slightly virtuous circle, is once you start to densify, and this is what happened in Melbourne. Prince is a great example. When I was a student, I lived in Melbourne. There was nothing here. There wasn't even a 7-Eleven in the CBD. And they brought in postcode 3000 and started bringing housing into the city. And then what they did do was grow a big ratepayer base. So you started getting more money into the local system, into local council, that paid for libraries, it pays for upgrades, for other things that allows. And once you get densification, you get people investing in those areas. So you get people coming in saying, well, I want to build a hospital. I'll build a private hospital. I'll build the health facilities here. I'll build the other stuff because I've got enough people there. I've got a catchment. They're not going to go and build. I mean, it's going to be us, the taxpayers, building it if you go and build it, 50 kilometres out of the CBD. So it does, it is proven, it does work. And it works. If you think
just
about,
needs to I be done that, well. It really does.
Yes.
And I do find it slightly ironic. I don't know if that word is strong enough and has the gravitas that it needs, in that we are, and this is slightly off topic, but we are pulling down high rises and saying that they are no longer fit for purpose. However, a lot of the high rises that we are pulling down are large, are 3-bedroom, have separate laundries, can fit a family. To be pulled down for smaller apartments where kitchens don't even exist, they're in your lounge room. The idea of pulling down high rises to build more high rises, how do we ensure that we build them properly and that they have longevity?
Were you talking about the social housing towers?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons around those, and I'm an advocate for retaining them as much as possible. So I think, we can retain much more than we do, and we should. But I totally agree with you. All of this needs to be considered as a whole, and it's a really complex problem. We can't just build new houses without infrastructure. But the idea of densification, of building them in within existing activity centres, is a sound one, but it needs to be done well. And what the plan for for Victoria says is that there's a hierarchy of these two. So there's a metropolitan scale, which is sort of Melbourne, Geelong. Then there's smaller major activity centres, which might be, you know, places like, say, Dandenong or Ringwood or other places that are a bit more smaller regional ones, but still have a densification and have really good activity centres within them. And then there's a smaller neighbourhood activity centres as well, which are more your sort of village type. You know, might be something like Westgarth or High Street in Northcote or those types of places, or Brunswick, or there is not a one size fits all. This is not, activity centres aren't just about building 20 story towers with them. They're a plan for the development of that whole centre over time, of that district over time. And what should be happening, and you could argue whether this is done well or not, is that there's proper strategic planning done around those centres to ensure that the heights are being built in the right places, that they're fit for purpose and they're fit for that specific location. That we're not just rolling out a blanket, you know,
yeah, model here.
It's all across the whole state. Yeah, so absolutely, it needs to be done. And the problem we always face in politics is that this is a 20 to 25 year plan. So it runs well outside the political cycles, and that makes it always tough.
Who picks it up and runs with it after that, and what looks right now, is it going to look right in 20 years' time? It's tricky. Simon, thank you. It's always really good to get your thoughts. I do think I know you just mentioned it briefly there, but then we have our regional city centres, and what does an activity centre look like in Ballarat or in Bendigo or Shepparton? So there's, I think that's a conversation for another day. But Simon Knott, good to speak with you. Thank you. Simon Knott, architect at BKK Architects. Keep those texts coming in. This, Rochelle, my concern about the number of apartments being built is that they're built properly. And when I moved into an apartment, there's been nothing with trouble, with so many things going wrong. Years and years and years of rework. The agent told us, and the amount of body corporate fees that we would have to pay as well, they're incredibly expensive on top of all the other bills you have to pay. So it's not necessarily a cheap alternative. That's from Judith. Judith, I know. And when you're talking 20 stories and you're talking lifts and things like that, all of a sudden your body corp fees go absolutely through the roof. Well, did you play D&D growing up? Maybe secretly you still got a 20-sided dice somewhere in the cupboard. But if you watched Stranger Things, you would have seen Hellfire Club. Maybe you have a Hellfire Club t-shirt. Well, Stranger Things and Hellfire Club may be making its way into the classroom.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And still coming up in the next half an hour, if you're a Guns N' Roses fan, then stay tuned. Maybe secretly you're a Gunners fan. Well, yeah, I've got some good news for you coming up. But if you play Dungeons and Dragons, maybe you played D&D when you were growing up, maybe there's someone in your house that plays it, or you just saw it on Stranger Things, right? And as a result, you pulled out your D20 again. That's a 20-sided dice. Yeah, I know. I had to ask someone about that. But they can go for days and days on end, Dungeons and Dragons campaigns, and Hellfire Club made it really cool again. But Hellfire Club may be making its way into the classroom. So Dungeons and Dragons, if you don't know, it's a role-playing game. And now there are programs rolling out across the country using modified educational versions of D&D to try and help teach neurodivergent kids skills like social communication, teamwork, and flexible thinking. So can you see the connection here? Do you think that this would help? Shadia Hancock is the owner and founder of Autism Actually, and also a self-described proud D&D enthusiast. Shadia, a warm welcome. Can you see how role play would help neurodivergent kids in school?
Yes. Well, given that I was a very enthusiastic D&D gamer in high school, I have first-hand experience of benefiting from it from a social point of view, but also for all of the reasons that you've outlined with regards to the flexibility and the creativity. So it's really exciting to hear that it's being considered for actual learning and implementation in schools, because certainly from my point of view and working with young people, it's been such a beneficial outlet.
So for those who don't know Dungeons and Dragons, can you sort of explain to us what it is, how it works?
Absolutely. So Dungeons and Dragons is what's known as a tabletop role-playing game. So basically, it's not an online game. Some people do play it online, but it's mainly, through the interactions that you have with the people around you at the table. Generally, you've got what's called a dungeon master or a game master who is sort of responsible for doing the world building, setting the scene, creating, you know, other characters that you might interact with as you go through the world as a party. And then, of course, you've got the other players, which, you know, there's so many different roles that you can play, even races and classes and all sorts of things. So I could literally talk about this for days.
I love it. I mean, honestly, Stranger Things sort of brought back a lot of, I never played it, but I had plenty of mates who did, and they would be lost on campaigns for days. You wouldn't see them for days on end. I don't even think they slept during the process. Is it too simplistic, Shadia, to look at the idea of, if you have autism or if you're neurodiverse in any way, socialising, talking to people might be something that's really frightening, something that doesn't come naturally. And the idea of role-playing just helps with that?
Oh, 100%. As an autistic ADHD myself, I've also encountered that personally, as well as obviously professionally, that often a lot of us autistic people prefer interest-based communication or structured activities as part of social interaction. Some of us just don't really find it interesting talking about general conversation, and we're much more motivated by specific interests. It's also the fact that it's so uncertain when we are going into unstructured social situations. For example, you know, what should I say? Did I say how are you correctly? Oh dear, have I asked them about how they've been going? Mm. And then all of that sort of thinking can be really, really exhausting actually for a lot of us. And I think particularly over COVID has been a source of, a lot of anxiety in our wider neurodivergent community. And I think the other lovely thing about having those structured game plays is if we're very, very knowledgeable in the game of choice or even aspects of role-playing, for example, suddenly our contributions are seen as strengths and assets to the group rather than, I guess, feeling behind the eight ball, so to speak, every time we're trying to interact with others in a group setting.
Do you reckon Stranger Things is going to help this?
I love Stranger Things, same. So I'm probably a bit biased. But
have you got the Hellfire Club t-shirt?
No, I need to get one. I know that a few of my friends have got some, so maybe I'll get them to organise something for me.
I know. That's interesting, right? There's a text here that says, D&D in classroom, seriously, what's next? But this is the future, looking at all types of gamings in the classroom. We know Minecraft is used in classrooms and teaching. Gaming, and this is old school gaming, right? This is role play. This is theatrics and using your brain. You don't even use a computer. You've got books and dice and all sorts of things. Do we need to start to think outside the square with how we teach and how we become more inclusive, and games is just a great way to do that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that really goes back to that idea of universal design for learning, particularly in a classroom setting. When you think about it, I would wager to guess that all students would probably enjoy more game-based, creative and even play-based interactions to even explore concepts. I think it will benefit our neurodivergent community immensely, but I would wager to guess that even our neurotypical students would quite enjoy those interactions. So definitely a big fan of, seeing more of those interactions. And I would dare say that there'll be a few teachers who are avid gamers who would probably love having the opportunity to be dungeon masters within a classroom.
Wouldn't that be great, where they're like, that's it, my two favourite things in the world have somehow combined and made its way back. Shadi, just finally, what's the longest D&D campaign you've played?
We started one in year 8 when I was in high school, and I think we started wrapping it up around year 11. So, yeah, no, 3 years is a pretty conservative estimate. I've known ones that have gone for much longer than that.
Wow. Oh, it's a whole new world. I love it. Well, I'm intrigued to see how this is going to work in schools. And, you know, you've got to roll the dice, if you don't mind the pun sometimes, and see what works and what helps. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Rochelle.
CEO Shadi Hancock, who is the owner and founder of Autism, actually in a self-described proud nerd and D&D enthusiast. So is Dungeons & Dragons being used at your school, or maybe your child is using it to help them with their school, or even just to help them communicate in some way, the world of role play, if that's happening in your school? Well, bust out your bandanas and your skin-tight jeans, because in news announced, I think yesterday, Guns N' Roses, Gunners, are coming to Australia. They've been referred to as the most dangerous band in the world. Are they? I'm not sure about that. Anyhow, they're set to play at the Adelaide Motor Grand Final later in the year. So Guns N' Roses, they formed in Los Angeles in the mid-80s. Their iconic debut album, Appetite for Destruction, will turn 40 next year. So will you be making the trip to Adelaide? Will you be there? Were you or are you a Gunners fan? Ryan Egan from Double J. I'm not a fan, yet I know every word to this song.
Oh, it's in there, isn't it? Hey, Rochelle. And the Snake Hips.
Oh,
do you remember the video?
Do Axel? I remember the video? He's got the moves. Oh, my goodness.
Has the moves. We'll see.
So, are they? I mean, they were labelled the most dangerous band in the world. I mean, that's a big call.
Well, you've got to love a label like that if you're a band, though, don't you? I mean, it sells the band. At the time, they felt really dangerous. They were sort of like this hard-drinking, hard-partying LA band, part of that sort of the end of the hair metal era, Motley Crue and all those sort of bands. And just at the beginning, or just at that sort of tipping point before alternative. So they just fitted in there perfectly. And the songs just really are stuck, particularly for me. Like, I was a teenager listening to Gunners.
And, I was a teenager growing up in Maui, listening to
regional
Gunners.
Regional Victoria, big fan of the Gunners where I was growing up.
You go roller skating on a Friday night. Oh, it can be the backward skate. It can be the romantic skate. They would have a song for all of them. And their songs were so long, as I remember today. So before we talk about the fact that they're coming to Adelaide and why it is that it's a motorsport event, yet again, a big sporting event has the one that has got the bucks to pay for international acts. In 1993, Guns N' Roses played here.
Yes.
It was a disaster. And you were there.
I was there. Yeah. It was one of those weird days where we had all the weather that day. I remember it being, I grew up in regional Victoria, took the bus with my mates to Calder Park Raceway. It started off about 35, 40 degrees. Then there was a massive dust storm. Then there was a huge downpour of and rain and lightning and thunder. And it was like, is this gig going to actually go on? And it went on for hours and hours and hours. It's like Rose Tattoo played and Pearls Before, I don't know, I can't remember the exact bands. It's all a blur. But then it took a long time for Gunners to come out. And we were so far away at Calder Park. It's just like it's just these tiny dots on stage. It was wild.
And since then, have they been back?
They have been back a couple of times, but they had a big period where they just were not active, or only Axl Rose was making music. And so there was this question mark over Guns N' Roses for many years, until probably the last maybe decade or more, where they've been back touring. And the key members of the band who are still touring together, Axl, Slash, of course, the iconic guitarist with the top hat.
I forgot about him.
Yeah, that's right. And the bass player are still together,
So the idea now of, I mean, they're here because they're playing in Adelaide for a sporting event. And the world, you know, are just colliding now between huge international acts and sporting events, and who has the money to bring these acts out. Are motor enthusiasts fanging it to Adelaide to see this event? Are Gunners fans going, like, who is this event for, do you think?
Well, this is a massive event, and it is huge. I think there's something like close to 300,000 people will attend this event over that period of time, and it's sort of taken the place over the last couple of years for Adelaide, I guess, of what, like, the Grand Prix does in Australia. Obviously, Adelaide had the Grand Prix for a long period of time as well, and it has had big artists before, so Crowded House, Chisel, and others have played at this event. And you want to get people to your event from interstate, and that potentially that tipping point for people can be an artist that they would want to see, that they can only see at this event, or that enhances the event in some way. So there's a tourism aspect to it as well. But, you know, this is a really massive event. I think Guns N' Roses is perfect for this supercar event, to be really honest.
I just forgot some of their songs. You ready?
Oh, yeah.
My lip's curling up even just listen to this.
We're in the jungle, baby.
Oh, yeah, man. And the squeal just keeps going. Still going.
Yeah, I mean...
It's
amazing.
It's actually, this is the interesting thing I find with music like this now. 15 in Maui, listening to this, sort of turn my back on it, saying I'm not one of those bogans. Now, yep. Listening to it, I'm like, this is awesome. Do we come around to this type of music as we age?
Well, it's so funny because when I was a kid as well, there was bands like Iron Maiden and they
Skid Row.
They seemed so heavy. Yeah. And my parents would have been like, you can't listen to this heavy stuff.
Yeah, are you a
It's just like Satanist? Pop music now. It's bizarre.
It's not that heavy, is it?
No, it isn't. But again, it's almost 40 years of this music being part of the world and in people's lives and in ads on sports shows at the bars you go to. So it's just a really now embedded thing. And their tours are enormous. They're bringing in millions and millions of dollars. And they're really at that perfect time with that perfect Gen X age and either side and the kids of the Gen Xers who are now discovering it to really to be
We're
frank,
taking our kids to the concerts.
And,
yeah.
You know, bring an amazing, you know, live show to people again with all the hits in the set.
There's nothing better than spinning out your teen when you know all the lyrics to a song that they think they have discovered. So 40 years of that album next year, will we expect to see? Because you were behind, you produced the J Files.
Yes.
Is that going to be
my
your
sins? Yeah, probably about, I don't know, about like eight years
legacy?
Ago, we did this, we did a little mini doco on Guns N' Roses. I actually went to a guitar shop for that documentary and asked a bunch of guitarists in the shop to play Sweet Child of Mine. Like, can you play it? Everyone could play it. Yeah. Like, it was just in everyone's back there, deep inside their psyche. So, yeah, I'm excited for the anniversary because I'm not necessarily a massive Guns N' Roses fan now. Like, if they have put out new music, they've got two new songs that have just come out in the last sort of 6 months, and they'll have a new album. But that album, Appetite for Destruction, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, big, big records for me. And, you know, once an album and an artist is stuck in there and is part of your DNA from being a teenager, it's exciting to go and see them again.
If you still have the – did you have the T-shirt? I can just see the T-shirt so clearly.
I didn't have a T-shirt, no.
No.
No, it had too many skulls on it. I don't think I would have been allowed to have it.
You wouldn't have been allowed to wear it.
Not allowed in church.
Oh, yeah. I was scared for life seeing Axl Rose in bike shorts on that tour. Says this particular text. So when you've got the people like Axl Rose or whoever it is coming back, it's the 40-year anniversary, do they still have it on stage? Like, do we expect them to act like they did 40 years ago? Is it okay? You know, you can't be ageist.
I think it's okay to give them some, to make space for them to do what they have to do when they're that age. I mean, we saw AC/DC last year. So this AC/DC did the same event last year. I saw those shows. And I was willing to kind of go, you know what, this is, they've been doing this for a long time.
They're in their 70s.
But they were amazing and they were incredible. And so I have no doubt that after doing so much touring in 2025, 2026 for Guns N' Roses, by the time they reach Australia, I think they'll be in pretty good form. They'll have, you know, as I said, three core members, original band and then new band members as well. I think it'll be great.
This from Damo. Gunners were considered rock and roll until Nirvana came along and made them look like camp pirates.
Well, it's true. The Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 were pretty much in the charts when Nirvana's Nevermind came through, and that whole sweep of grunge just pushed away all of that classic rock, hair metal and sounds of the time. So, yeah, they're interesting
were
band to be at a transition point.
Like, when we look at music now, were Guns N' Roses or are they still influential, do you think?
I think so because there are rock bands still around now, particularly with someone like Slash you know, who is such an iconic guitarist and a you know, an incredible player and has amazing riffs. I think if you're a rock and roll guitarist over the last 20, 30 years, you can't help but be influenced by Slash in the same way that Slash and others would have been influenced by Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin and, you know, Eric Clapton from Cream and that kind of heavy rock stuff of the 60s and 70s. So the influence is probably through more of that sort of stuff.
Given how long some of their songs were, right? So this is their ballad. Remember this?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Did you not go to a house party in the 90s and someone didn't bust out a guitar and play this?
I can see that guy. I can see Trent right now in the lounge room.
Play it, Trent. Come on, here's the guitar, Trent.
Play it again.
Oh, I'd forgotten. This has taken me back to my high school days.
It's a long intro.
It's so long. It's so long. It keeps going, man. Did they get radio play?
Yeah, they did. But, I don't know. It's I can't remember now whether... I mean, this is Patient. So this got played a heap.
It's nearly 6 minutes long. If you needed, back in the 90s, if you needed a Diet Coke and a ciggy break, you could put this on. And...
Maybe music programmers just cut it up and we didn't realise.
Here we go.
Shed a tear cause I'm missing you. I'm still alright to smile.
I know all the words, how
Rochelle,
sad.
You know it all.
I know it all. Oh my God, it's making me smile though. Anyway, are you going to leg it to Adelaide to see Gunners?
You know what, cross my fingers they do some other shows here. They haven't been announced, but yeah, we'll see. If they're not coming to other, you know, to Melbourne in November, maybe they'll come back next year and I'll see them then.
We'll see. A little bit. You ready? Here we go. Come on.
Said woman,
gotta get your phone out. Turn the light on your phone.
Things will work out fine.
I don't know the words.
All we need is just a little
the phone is out. There's nothing like reliving the 90s.
Don't have a lighter anymore.
No, that's it. Oh, how times have changed. As always, Ryan Egan from Double J, thank you. Just quickly, did you play Dungeons & Dragons? I've got a vibe you might have been a D&D guy.
I dabbled a little bit. I played it more in the video game versions rather than the pencil and paper versions in the library with friends. Oh, I've always really wanted to get into it. I heard your caller before. Yeah. It sounded so exciting. I should do it. Maybe this is my new thing.
We're bringing it all back.
2026.
Ryan Egan, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Oh, I've just been taken back to my lounge room in Moi on High Street, mid-90s. Someone I'd barely know with a guitar singing Patience, the good old days. But if you've just joined us, we were talking about Dungeons and Dragons and the idea of sort of versions of Dungeons and Dragons being rolled out throughout schools to help neurodiverse kids with everything from just social connection and the idea that role play can help them in everyday life. Maybe this is something that's happening at your school. Gemma's in Bentley. Good morning.
Oh, hi. I'm a speech pathologist. I've been a speech therapist for 20 years and a Dungeons & Dragons player for 10. So I thought I would call...
You're the perfect call. So how can you see it helping?
Well, look, for me, being able to support my patients in their goals around their social communication, their conversation, their relationship building is really important. And group therapy is an incredibly important part of that. And Dungeons and Dragons is just one way to do that in a really supportive and inclusive way. It uses so many skills.
So what sort of skills does it use?
So often what happens in Dungeons and Dragons, it's a little bit like you're participating in a movie. So somebody's sort of saying, here, you know, everybody is having a picnic today. We're all sitting around and all of a sudden, you know, a tree falls over and it's about to hit the picnic rug. What do you do? And so if I'm playing, I might be a character in the game and I'm thinking, oh God, okay, well, what can I think of? What can I create in my mind? And then how can I create the sentences that go around that? How can I explain and describe that to everybody else so that they understand me? And then I've got to make lots of decisions, you know, because maybe somebody else tried to grab the tree or tried to, you know, pull me out of the way. How do I react to that? So it uses a huge number of cognitive and linguistic skills just embedded as part of the game.
So how do you then create a version of it that would work within school? Because you're not going to be just playing Dungeons and Dragons in school instead of something else.
No, but we do put a lot of programs together, and we do know that play is a really important part of learning for young people. So part of speech therapy includes developing play skills. So it's embedded as part of our practice as well. And Dungeons and Dragons has versions that are appropriate that, you know, provide more rules and more clear understanding for kids to be able to play.
Why do they?
Yeah, there are children-specific versions of Dungeons & Dragons. And also I assume that, you know, some of the research that's come out have been neurodivergent-specific versions themselves. And I've not played those. But I
love that it's just evolved over time.
Yeah.
So, Gemma, so you said you took it up 10 years ago. What made you take it up as an adult?
My brother used to play it, and he moved to Canada, and so we wanted a way to connect without just chatting about what life was like. And so every month we get together online with a couple of other of my friends, and it's a way for us to stay in touch, you know, and have an opportunity to do something together when we can't be together.
The future of gaming somehow being intertwined into our schooling. It takes a lot for people to get their head around it. You always get pushback.
Yeah.
But this is such an old school, traditional pen and paper way. I mean, yes, you can play versions online. But I wonder whether there will be greater acceptance of Dungeons and Dragons being intertwined into curriculum or into a way to learning in some way, because it's not video gaming as such.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, it takes, there's literacy skills, there's numeracy skills. You know, you've got to count the numbers on the dice to see how successful you were at the action that you wanted to do. Because after this tree falls down and I've decided I'm going to jump out of the way, I've got to roll my dice to see if I do. And then I've got to count all of my dice up and be able to work out if I could do that, if I could jump really well or if I couldn't.
I love it.
So,
so do you use it? I could speak to you all day, Gemma, but do you use it in your practice as a speech pathologist?
I actually, unfortunately, I work in a hospital setting at the moment, so no, I don't use it in that sector. But I've definitely referred a number of kids who were interested to various places that do run those sorts of programs.
Thank you for letting me ask you 10,000 questions, Gemma.
You're most welcome. Anytime. You know, it's a really fun game if you've never tried it. You know, and I think it's really helpful in the neurodivergent community. So I'm a strong advocate for it.
Yeah, I think it's just about social inclusion in general, really, isn't it? And taking that label off it. I was talking earlier about how long D&D campaigns can run. How long has one of your campaigns lasted?
A year and a half in one of the ones I play and about 2 years in the other.
Wow. All right. So you're in it for the long haul.
Yeah, we are.
Thank you so much. Lovely to speak with you. Thank you.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
See ya. Keep those calls coming through, 1-300-222-774. If Dungeons & Dragons has somehow just helped you with your social skills in life, or if you've seen it be included in your school, if it's been brought into your curriculum in any way, and in particular to help kids who may be neurodiverse, and a lot of your secret love coming out for Guns N' Roses, and whether or not you'll be legging it to Adelaide to see them. Rish, I played in a metal band for 17 years and the band is still going. It's about to hit 30 years. We used to have a saying, everyone likes heavy metal, they just don't know it yet. I think you might be right. As we age, I somehow really like, well, not heavy metal, hair metal, you know, that long hair metal. Anyhow, it's just something that's growing on me. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.